We were left to get on with life as though none of it had ever happened. 20 people came back to the house afterwards. They ate our food, drank our booze, and then they disappeared. In the end, Marsha got a ride to the airport with one of the Bay Area uncles. She said she'd keep in touch, and as I hugged her goodbye, I told her I wouldn't be holding my breath. She just smiled. I knew it was going to be weird. Although I'd known Ronnie for years and we'd got on well enough, my father had been the common denominator in the house. Without him, we were going to be a couple of strangers who, under any other circumstances, shouldn't even know each other, let alone live together. Ronnie must have been aware of this too, and dealt with it by basically moving into Bistro 1769. "Don't worry about me," she said, with a smirk, as she was leaving on the afternoon, 3 days after the funeral. "I've given the maitre d' your cell number, just in case I get out of line." Later that night, my mom calls to express her regret at not making the funeral. I could tell she was drunk. When I didn't say anything in return, she gave me a hard time for giving her a hard time. It wasn't her fault that my father had a wandering eye or was completely unreliable. It wasn't her fault that my father was absorbed in his work. It wasn't her fault that she hadn't been at home more often, etc., etc. During the call, I microwaved and ate my evening meal with the receiver clamped between my ear and shoulder, and I drank a bottle and a half of red wine to stop myself from shaking. I was angry and scared and lost all at the same time, and I had no idea why I was feeling everything except sad. "Nothing's as it seems," were her final words to me. "I'm not the enemy, Michael." I didn't know what she meant by that, but by then I was in such a rage that after I hung up, I broke the phone by punching it against the wall. Then I tore down a display case that held my father's collection of souvenir Ferrari plates and model cars, leaving the floor looking like plastic, ceramic and glass confetti had been scattered over it. That was when Ronnie walked into the room, swaying slightly on her feet. She asked me what had happened, and when I didn't answer, she asked what was wrong. I told her I was empty and I didn't know what to do. She stood and looked deep into my eyes for more than a minute, her stare never flinching. When a tear rolled down her cheek, she broke the silence and said she felt exactly the same. Then we hugged. I kissed her cheek, tasting her tears, and then instinct and wine moved me towards her lips, but something pulled me back, not quite touching, but close enough to feel her breath on my face. Sheepishly, I closed my eyes and hung my head so that her foreheads touched. Her hands came up to brush my face. "I know," she whispered. And with that, she took my hand and led me upstairs. When I woke the next morning, Ronnie was gone. She'd left a note on the breakfast counter in the kitchen. "You must hate me," she wrote. "For what it's worth, I'm sorry. What happened last night was a mistake. It was disrespectful to your father, who I honestly loved more than I thought I could love anyone. I've been called a gold digger so many times by Marsha and the rest of them, and I know that's how it must look to you now. But I loved him, and I'm so broken and lonely without him. I'd give anything for you to believe me. I'll make this easy for both of us, and I'll move out. You can have the house."